Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Smith v. Goetz. Mr. Blegen.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the Court. Joseph Smith's trial in 1995 in the Circuit Court of Cook County for murder and armed robbery was fraught with problems, and it was also a closely balanced trial. The evidence against Mr. Smith amounted essentially to the eyewitness testimony of three individuals, but those three individuals themselves had problems. Drug use during the time of the identification or shortly before it, alcohol use before it, and one eyewitness who literally identified the petitioner for the first time in court 3 years after the incident, having walked into the courtroom with the state's attorney beforehand and seen the petitioner sitting at counsel table. In addition, the only other significant piece of evidence against the defendant was a confession. But it was an oral confession, which was never reduced to writing, never signed, and which the petitioner denied that he had ever made when he took the witness stand. There were also several errors involved in the trial.
Don't you have a very serious problem with a failure to have, not your failure, of course, his failure to have raised these issues in his first state post-conviction proceeding?
I will, yes, concede that it is a problem. It's a problem that I think we can get around, and if you'd like me to address that, I will.
Sure.
The first issue is I believe that it's pretty clear-cut that he has not procedurally defaulted his confrontation argument. And essentially that argument is the one where the state put on a detective and was allowed to admit over objection what they call course of conduct hearsay testimony. Essentially, the detective said, I had one witness identify Antoine Edwards as having participated in the shooting. I then went and had Antoine Edwards come in. He was picked out of a lineup. He gave me a statement. We had a conversation. And immediately thereafter, we went to pick up the murder weapon, and we went to pick up, along with Mr. Edwards, the petitioner. The implication being obvious to the jury that Antoine Edwards had implicated the petitioner. If that wasn't clear just from the testimony, the state pounded it into the jury's head in closing and in rebuttal by essentially saying this testimony of Detective, I forget his name, Bundit or something, was very important. He talked to Antoine Edwards. Antoine Edwards gave him a statement, and then they went to go get the gun and go get petitioner.
Well, are you saying this wasn't defaulted?
I don't believe it was defaulted, and here's why. He raised it on his direct appeal. And that court said that it was waived for not being placed in for not being objected to, which I disagree with. I think it was objected to, and we put that in our brief, and for not being put in the post-trial motions, and I'll discuss that in a moment. But the most important reason that it wasn't procedurally defaulted is that it was ruled on the merits by the appellate court in what this court has called an intertwined ruling or interwoven ruling between default and the merits. And the court spent about a sentence and a half on waiver, that they called it, but about six pages on the merits. And then the petitioner raised it in his petition for leave to appeal to the Illinois Appellate Court. So that issue, I think, is not defaulted. And the other issue is, and I'm both embarrassed and I don't want to...
I don't understand the intertwined. What's that about?
Well, this court has said in a case called Moore versus Bryant that where a merits decision and a default decision are interwoven, I think is the exact term.
What does that mean?
Well, what I think to be interwoven means is where they're joined together and is part of the same opinion and same discussion. Which is precisely
what if the court says this issue is defaulted, but just in case, you know, maybe someone will disagree with that, so we'll go on, we'll discuss the merits, right? Why would that wipe out the default?
Because then the appellate court has ruled on the merits of the issue, and this court has said that in those circumstances you will not find waiver.
But I don't understand that. How does the validity of the ruling, how is the validity of a ruling on default undermined by the fact that the court, out of an abundance of caution, goes on and says, well, if we're wrong about it, we think we're right, and we think it was defaulted, but if we're wrong, it doesn't matter because we don't think the argument has any merit.
Well, in that situation, it may be that it would be defaulted. That's not what the Illinois Appellate Court did here. They didn't say alternatively or in case we're wrong.
In what sense were they interwoven?
They're part of the same discussion. They're part of the same paragraph in the decision, and they are joined
why
together.
Why would that make a difference? I don't understand why their placement. I can see a difference if somehow the ruling on a default was somehow dependent on the merits, but I don't see why they have to be in different paragraphs.
I would suggest that the ruling does have to do, the ruling on the merits does have to do with the default, because then the court, if for example, they just said it was waived or maybe forfeited for not putting it in the post-trial motion, then they would have to review it under a different standard of review. And they would say, well, maybe under a plain error standard, it still wouldn't meet the merits situation. So
the court clearly did rule in the alternative, though, even though it didn't use the word alternatively. The court said this claim is waived and would fail even if reviewed on the merits. That's an alternative holding, not an intertwined holding.
Well, our position is that the court then went on to discuss that. But the what I think saves all of his claims is that there is the likelihood of actual innocence here. And the reason is there was weak evidence, so weak that a jury, after deliberating, couldn't return a unanimous verdict after four separate votes and only returned a unanimous verdict after being sequestered overnight in one of those hotels that they put people up in out of 26th Street when they
What's the test for actual innocence?
Test for actual innocence is, one, it is it's very rare, no doubt. But it applies where a constitutional violation has likely caused the conviction of someone who is actually innocent. That's the standard. And here we've got, in addition to the weak evidence, the troubles that the jury itself had, the people who
were. I think all you're saying is that there wasn't proof beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, that's not what I'm intending to say. No, because we also have evidence from outside of the trial record. Affidavits from one individual.
Well, I don't think they're worth much.
Well, with all due respect, when courts discuss actual innocence, they weigh the new evidence against the evidence that came in. And here I would submit the new evidence outweighs the evidence that was admitted at trial. An individual who knew the petitioner and was present has indicated that petitioner was not one of the participants in the shooting. And another individual has said that he saw petitioner at his home.
That kind of evidence is very common in these cases. Finding someone to say, oh, yeah, it wasn't him, it was me, or it was someone else, very common.
I admit that it may be common, but not in a case where the evidence, as the jury clearly thought, was weak. And I would submit that the evidence here of these two witnesses is substantially stronger than the eyewitness identification of the others. Before I eat up all of my rebuttal time, that issue could have been resolved by way of an evidentiary hearing. The issue of was there this likelihood of actual innocence, we requested an evidentiary hearing, and the district court could have heard from those witnesses herself. And I'd like to reserve the rest of my time with
that. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Reagan. Mr. Malamut?
Good afternoon, Your Honors, counsel, and may it please the court. My name is Eldon Malamuth, here today from the Illinois Attorney General's Office on behalf of appellee. Petitioner raises four claims, which he argues entitle him to habeas relief, but he has defaulted all of them, either for not raising them through one complete round of the established appellate court process or because the state courts denied them on an independent and adequate state law ground. Turning towards the issue of the merits analysis on the Confrontation Clause, I will address that briefly. As the Court indicated, as Your Honors indicated, the State Appellate Court was pretty clear about what it was doing. Your Honor asked whether it had to be in separate paragraphs. Well, even if it didn't have to be, in this case it is in separate paragraphs. That's in the second appendix for in the petitioner's brief and his opening brief on pages 15 and 16. The court was clear it went through the fact that he failed to object to the testimony during trial and in a post-trial motion, and then stated this contention is waived on appeal. And the court then went on to say that even without the invocation of waiver, this contention is without merit. So the court is clearly was pretty clear on what it was doing. To touch briefly on petitioner's invocation of Moore versus Bryant, he argues that that case in some ways stands for the proposition that the state appellate court's merits determination lessens the impact of its holding on the procedural ground. But all Moore versus Bryant actually stands for is the proposition that the last state court to address the matter determines whether or not the issue was defaulted. In Moore, the court appeared to be, court on direct appeal appeared to have a dual ground holding. And then in subsequent post-conviction proceedings, the post-conviction appellate court ignored the forfeiture, ignored the earlier forfeiture. And this court was simply stating that state courts can ignore their own procedural rules if they choose, not that federal courts should ignore the procedural grounds when it is clear that the last state court relied on it, as it was here. Touching also very briefly on the actual innocence claim, the evidence here was quite strong. There was the confession to the police officer and the assistant state's attorney that matched the eyewitness testimony. There was the eyewitness testimony. On the flip side, the petitioner has one affidavit stating that somebody saw him home alone without any explanation of how that could be possible. And the affidavit itself was never presented to state court. The other affidavit is from an affiant who has already contradicted himself twice. And so the evidence, even if it would be a wash, which it would not be, would not be established actual innocence. Unless the court has any further questions, Appelli would ask that the...
I don't understand your argument about the hearsay.
On the merits, Your Honor?
Yeah.
The argument there is that the petitioner is stating that there was an implication, some sort of improper implication. He's not arguing that there was any actual hearsay statement. He points to no established Supreme Court precedent holding that the implication...
Well, what difference does it make? I don't understand.
Well, the difference, Your Honor, is that the the state appellate court found
that
there wasn't...
You quote from the Federal Rules of Evidence, nonverbal conduct of a person if it is intended by the person as an assertion.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't believe that...
That's a statement.
That would be right, Your Honor. I don't believe that refers to...
Well, what do you think it
case.
Refers to?
I believe that would refer to perhaps an instance where, let's say, someone, a testifying person indicated that he or she asked a non-testifying person a question, and that person nodded in the affirmative. Well, there you have a nonverbal communication.
Well, here the nonverbal conduct is leading them to to the petitioner, right?
Yeah,
taking
him
by the hand to Smith's house. Why isn't that the same as saying Smith did it?
Well, Your Honor, here the argument is that he spoke with the detective spoke with a suspect, and then later he and the suspect at some point after that or directly after that went to a certain house. Now certainly you could form an inference and there could be an implication that one there was cause and effect there, but that is not the kind of direct.
So what? I don't understand. What's the point of that? If you can draw the inference, why isn't that just as damaging as nodding?
Well, Your Honor, this has to do with the rule. The rule has to do with statements, and is again.
Well, no, the rule includes nonverbal conduct. Now, why can't leading a person to a house be nonverbal conduct?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, I would say the first this claim has been waived as defaulted.
That's irrelevant,
but,
right? I'm asking you about the merits.
Okay. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I didn't mean to answer irrelevantly. To me, it seems that there's a clear purpose, and that there was the rule at the time, which was Ohio versus Roberts. That's the precedent, the only precedent that petitioner can point to. Now, that precedent, whether or not in a new setting, Your Honor might find that this implication should be covered under that rule, it is not a fact that the established Supreme Court precedent at the time of the decision.
No, I understand that argument. That's a separate argument. That's fine, but it's your argument that this isn't hearsay that bothered me.
What's the point of this line of questioning if not to suggest the content of the interview between the detective and the absent witness?
Well, Your Honor, there has been many precedents from this court and others allowing testimony regarding the police procedure in an investigation.
This isn't a procedural line of questioning.
Your Honor,
it's clearly substantive. And that's borne out by the closing argument, the use that the prosecutor made of this line of questioning in closing argument. It's very important to note that after that conversation, referring to the conversation between the detective and Antoine Edwards, where does he go? Where does Antoine Edwards go? He goes to Detective Duffin, and then he goes with Detective Duffin to the house of Joseph Smith.
Your Honor, it is certainly
there's
true
only
that
one way to interpret that.
That's the prosecutorial, the closing arguments used or pointed to these statements in a way that was probably beyond how these investigative testimonies normally go. Again, I would point out that's in some ways a separate claim than the actual statement of the testimony, but regardless, in this case, there is no established Supreme Court precedent that would hold that on these facts, the matter would be a violation of the Confrontation Clause. And so, with respect to the ineffective assistance of counsel argument that the petitioner is then trying to weave into this for not raising it also later, that's a somewhat separate argument. But in any event, there are other factors with respect to this claim that would the fact that there was no established Supreme Court precedent that would lead to this claim being rejected in this situation.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Malamuth.
Thank you.
Mr. Legan, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
I'd first like to concede that counsel was correct. It was in separate paragraphs that I discussed. I must have not noticed that or forgotten it. But here's why that argument has not been waived was a ruling contrary to established Supreme Court precedent. Ohio versus Roberts, which came out long before Crawford v. Washington, established that that hearsay statements cannot come in unless they are subject to cross-examination, the person was not present, or that there are other indicia of reliability which the state has to prove, and they didn't even make an effort to do that in this case. As for the waiver issue, and I was starting to say this earlier, I believe there's an argument to be made, and I'm a little embarrassed that this might put another level of forfeiture into this case. There's an argument to be made that trial counsel did include this argument in his post-trial motions, and the reason I'm embarrassed is because I didn't notice it until preparing for oral argument. But in the post-trial motions, there's a reference, an argument made that the state was trying to get around the severance problem or get around the fact that this Antoine Evans was severed, and it's at the record, the common law record 62 through 63 is the post-trial motions, and it's a bit of a wordy argument written by a kind of a well-known trial lawyer here in the city, Sam Adams Sr., but he does get to that point, I think, where he says Sixth Amendment violation, confrontation. And so I think that the appellate court was wrong, and the court should find that argument was properly preserved.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Bleen. You were appointed, were you not? So we thank you for your efforts on behalf of your client, and we thank Mr. Malamuth as well.